Hello and welcome back to Ice World with me, Nadia Frontier, marine biologist working with the British Antarctic Survey. In this podcast, we feature conversations about living and working in Antarctica. And this time we meet two of Rothera's station's electronics engineers, Jonathan Witherstone and Jas Kieran Nagy. During their respective winters, both electronics engineers were constantly monitoring equipment and responding to cold damage during events of snow accumulation or cold weather. They were both responsible for keeping the vital communication lines working and took on extra roles, as we'll hear later on during the episode. First, I spoke to Jonathan. We met at Rothera in November 2021, after my first winter, and then we wintered together again until March 2023. When we spoke, he had been stationed at Rothera for almost a year. I asked him about what he loved about being an engineer and what originally brought him to Antarctica.
Mainly looking at fitting scientific instruments to planes. So we have two planes here. Well, we have more than two, but two of the planes we have here can be fitted with scientific instruments, AZ and BL, which are just the tail numbers. But BL, I came down here to fit BL with an ice radar, so a radar that can scan ice thickness and tell you about the composition of the ice. The thing about the radar is you can't use it anywhere else in the world, really. It's really specific to ice. So obviously you can use it
in the north,
but yeah. The ice is completely different. Like, this is big glaciers, so you can use it for big glacier stuff elsewhere. But yeah, it's pretty specific to Antarctic.
And then, so before coming to Antarctica, how long had you worked with the British Antarctic Survey in Cambridge?
So I think I was, before coming down the first time, I'd been there for a year, but I'm mainly working on the other aircraft. So there's another fit, science fit, that is a meteorological fit, so it measures kind of lots of different parameters in the air column. Basically, I've got this engineering degree that really limits you to inside work, and I hate working inside.
But then what is it about engineering that you love?
I love knowing how things work. I think that's the standard answer most engineers will give. But yeah, as a kid, you're always taking stuff apart and sometimes being able to put it back together. It's just knowing how things work and figuring out what's wrong is also really interesting to me. So going back and figuring out what caused the problem, and sometimes you don't know, and that actually kind of annoys me. I really want to know what caused
it. Just keep troubleshooting until you can find the issue.
Yeah.
So you've taken a sabbatical from your Cambridge job as an engineer to winter at Rothera.
Yeah.
What on earth made you want to do that?
So there's a few things, I think. The main one for me is that I feel like I'd always regret not doing it. That's the main reason, really, is that I was at the time of my life where I could just leave the UK. And I think a lot of people have wintered or talk about wintering as if it's like this big mystique, this big thing.
Yeah.
Which
interesting.
Is interesting. And you have plumbers and chippies and doctors and marine biologists. And you have all of these people crammed in together.
Yeah.
I think that's super cool. And
that is the beauty of it.
It's just an amazing environment to live in.
What's your favourite moment?
I think probably the best day of the winter trip, which wasn't actually, for my first one, wasn't really in winter, but was skiing to the bottom of N2, climbing N2 and then skiing back. Like, that's just a super cool thing to go do.
Like our back garden is a glacier.
Yeah.
And we're looking at that. In fact, we're actually speaking right now looking at that glacier.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then the amazing night stars.
Oh, night and skies. Capturing those on time lapses and astrophotography is just incredible. But even without long exposures, just looking at the sky.
You'll never get that anywhere else.
Wow. So, John, tell me about your job at Rothera. What do you actually do here?
No one ever knows what I do here.
But talk about the aspects of your job that are different to the routine monitoring.
So the electronics engineer here at Rothera, the role's kind of split into two or three different bits. So in summer, we go to field sites and service a variety of different sites, GPS sites or LPMs, which are low-power magnetometers. So different scientific instruments that are measuring different parameters in Antarctica. And then in the rest of the time, when we're at Rothera, we're either preparing to do that. So a lot of the winter is actually spent preparing to go into the field and just making sure everything, like all the batteries are good and all the different bits and bobs are good, really, and we've got the right stuff to get us ready to go. And looking after instruments that are here on the point. So here at Rothera, anything that's outside here gets absolutely hammered by the weather. Like it's getting iced up and then it gets blown to 60 knots or it's everything. Nothing electronics is designed really to be outside in this kind of environment. We look after all the radios on station and talking to the planes and the field parties and I guess also the satellite links really. It's kind of shared with the IT role as well. So making sure that all that when people get to go to the field, their radio works, which is pretty crucial. That's poor comms can cost a lot of money. And back in the day, it would have been the only way to talk to someone would have been an HF radio. The Iridium network is flawed in a few ways. So having the HF is the primary, I think, is a really...
So the Iridium is like essentially a little satellite phone.
Yeah,
a
tiny
people
little.
Have,
yeah.
And it connects to a satellite, yeah. And can make a call. So if somebody's in the field, then they can then call station or yeah. a UK.
I mean, yeah, you can call. UK's you can call.
Be of any help.
You can call any number you like with an Iridium number. It's just because it's such a delay, it's got to go all the way to space and back down to wherever it's going. Whereas a HF, if it's set up in the right way, so that's a high frequency radio. So a radio it's like a pretty old school bit of kit. And it just works. But if it's set up in the right way, you can just have a standard conversation. Like you can just push a button and chat as if they're next to you.
What's the greatest distance that the HF can extend to?
So Midwinter's broadcast,
mm-hmm.
Oh,
of course.
We listened to that, and that was being transmitted from the UK. So
not from the Ascension Islands?
No. So they did a test broadcast over lots of different places, and the best transmitter was in the UK. So we listened on Midwinter's Day. We listened to the one from the UK. So that's what is that? That's 8,000 miles.
8,000 miles away.
8,000 miles away.
Amazing. Yeah. What do you do when the cables get iced up?
Yeah, it's a really high tech approach. We hit it with a stick. So we just hit the ice off. Normally, it works. The worst is the radome. Actually, the VSAT link to get our internet is just a big white dome.
Loves wet snow.
Any kind of hint of a small amount of wet snow and the front of it will get completely snowed up. And annoyingly, it has to face north.
It receives.
It's a geostationary satellite, so a satellite around the equator. So it's just looking slightly up and to the north. And because our predominant wind is northerly, the front of it just gets immediately caked in wet snow.
And then what do you do then?
We brush it. We go out with a brush in horrible weather and just brush the snow off. I've actually upgraded the brush.
To?
A squeegee. It works way better.
Oh, I did hear that, yeah.
Yeah, so we stole a squeegee from the cleaning cupboard and a glacier pole, and you can properly squeegee it. And then Louis, the brother IT, has on the other side put a paint scraper so you can scrape the ice off. So it's double-ended. You got a squeegee and a scraper.
Oh, God, you guys.
It's genius.
I mean, that is engineering to the next level, right?
It's duct taped on and everything.
Wow. Yeah. Do you miss anything from home?
Do I miss anything? I miss my boat more than I miss anything else. Like, I miss living...
Just to confirm, you have a canal boat.
Yeah, so I live on a narrowboat.
Narrowboat.
I live on a 56-foot narrowboat on the Cam in Cambridge. And it's in the middle of nowhere, and it's beautiful. Like, the... waking up to the sound of coots or ducks or whatever. It's super cool. And also I love that it's inside and warm and cozy, but you're really quite connected to nature. Like when it's windy, you know about it.
Is there anything else you want to talk about?
I loved going on the SDA for the first time and seeing the video wall. It's like a really tiny thing, right? It's a 4x3 group of monitors. But the engineering behind putting those monitors on the wall took years.
What was it for?
As a cruise is happening, everyone can tell what's going on at the same time.
Okay.
And the theory is that they have more than one of those all around the ship. So anyone can look at the same screen and tell what's going on. They were talking about how to do it and the structure of the wall, and it's like quite a lot of weight and how you actually communicate to the screen and like get the information on the screen. And it took ages. Like it took a fair amount of time to come up with this thing. And then I saw it and was like, oh, this is cool. And it's super simple. Like it actually took two engineers because the first person who designed it left. So they designed it and someone picked it up and was like, oh, I don't like in the standard engineer way. I don't like how someone else has done it. Yeah. So I completely redesigned it. So they wanted to be able to remove a monitor from the middle without removing any other monitors. So to actually do that is really hard when they're butted up next to each other. Like, how do you get anything in to remove the middle one?
Yeah.
So that's actually quite a hard problem.
Deconstruct everything around it.
Yeah.
How do they do that?
It's like, so the original design was two levers and you have to pull both levers out. And then, but this one is just like, you can pop the screen in and out. Like it's a mechanism that you can just like push it and it comes out. The other thing is it's got to be able to deal with the Drake, right? Like the pitching and the rolling of the Drake, like the Drake's Passage.
Which is the roughest sea in the world.
Supposedly. I've never done it. Well, supposedly.
Oh, yeah. I have, yeah.
How was it?
Yeah, it was really calm. We had it like, I love it when it's super rolling because you're just laying in bed at night and you can just hear like all this ballast water moving and it sounds haunting, but it's so fun and the bed's moving and you're like literally it feels like you're going into the sea as well. So I was really looking forward to that on the Drakes and then it was just like really calm, flat, boring sailing. Not boring. Awesome. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
And that was John, the Southern Hemisphere's go-to man, with a squeegee for when Rotherham's internet goes down. Proof that engineering isn't just about electronics, it's also about finding solutions. Jonathan has resumed his role of an electronics instrumentation engineer in Cambridge, and as a slight detour, he just went to Halley for a summer season to fill in for a position last minute as an engineer. Next up, we'll speak to Jas Kieran, or Jas, another one of Rotherham's electronics engineers. He was Jonathan's predecessor. Jas looked after land-based science and HF, that's high-frequency communication channels, and various equipment. I wintered with Jas at Rotherham from December 2020 until February 2021. You might actually recognise his voice from season 2 of the Ice World podcast when we sailed together on the James Clark Ross to get all the way from the UK to Antarctica during a 2-month passage. Jas also talks about the RF, that's radio frequency, during the interview. But Jas never thought he'd end up as an engineer. Never mind in Antarctica.
I don't know how, but I fell into electronics and I love it because I feel like it's one of those things that you can let your mind wander and you can build a superpower. That's what I've always wanted to be, a superhero. And I feel like Iron Man was the closest you can get to being a superhero in real life. And that's why I love electronics and then fell down the rabbit hole. And I'm here. Which is cool.
That's really cool. So when choosing your university degree to become a superhero, what course did you pick?
Electronics engineering, specialising in satellite communications.
So when you first came out of university, what was the first job you took?
I went to Halley.
So that's one of Antarctica's research stations.
It's on the Brunt Ice Shelf. And Halley's pretty cool because Halley is all about RF science. So it's all about looking at the aurora above Halley. It's looking at lightning strikes around the world. It's looking at how RF travels in the atmosphere. Like the height of the stratosphere varies, and that height can dictate how, for example, submarine transmitters transmit around the world. So we have instruments that look at Russian submarine transmitters and look at how they change to tell us the height of the stratosphere, which is really cool. And there's an instrument there which looks at VHF, which is like a normal walkie-talkie frequency. They ping it out into space, and using what they measure back, they can look at meteorites entering the atmosphere. It's really cool. There's a lot of metadata from RF.
That's super cool. So at Halley, were you in charge of maintaining these instruments, or did you also get to do some deep field work?
So Halley has a giant chasm that's running through the ice shelf.
So a chasm is like a crevasse?
Not like a crevasse. It is, the ice shelf is splitting into two, and there's about a kilometre holding on at the moment. And my job was primarily to install these GPS sites. So 17 of them all around the Brunt Ice Shelf and looking at how the ice shelf was moving. And there was like a couple on the other side of the crack, a couple on the Halley side of the crack, and how quickly that they were spreading and moving. And more than science, this was for ops, so they can reassure that the crack was stable. And if there was any big shifts in the GPS data, they would know. And then they could, I don't know, fly us all out early. It's like an early warning system.
Or relocate the station. How close was that chasm to the actual research station?
20 kilometres. So you could see the research station from the chasm. Pretty close.
That's pretty scary. Did you lay in bed at night thinking that the crack was going to just...
Nah, it's so stable. And there's so many precautions around it. There's always a plane available to evacuate Halley if needed. And all there are these GPS sites which can measure down to like the 2-centimeter level. So really, we could see that the chasm kind of fluctuating in high winds because one of the walls acted like a sail and it was picking up all this wind. And we could actually see during strong blows, like the whole crack kind of oscillating. And there's another instrument we installed, which was it's called the AP res. It emits a burst of RF energy and reflects off this like steel structure, which was a dog cage near the side. And using some clever maths and phases and stuff, it can measure down to like the tenth of a millimeter how quickly the chasm was growing. And we install it, but well, we installed it at a crack that was a centimeter wide. And they went this year, and it was about 30 meters wide. So what we were hopping over this crack, left, right, and centre,
has massively expanded.
Now is just, you can barely see to the other side. It's incredible.
I wonder what it'll be like next year.
Yeah.
That's scary. Are these changes attributed to climate change, or are they shifts in natural shifts when the ice is expanding or the glaciers are moving?
We don't have enough data to say for certain. Certainly, the brunt has always calved, and it was due a calving event.
Okay, so this time round, moving away from your Halley summer contract of a couple of months, did you have any apprehensions about accepting a contract for 18 months? Was it quite hard to leave your family, and especially in the middle of a COVID pandemic?
Massively, massively, actually. So when I was offered the Halley winter, I say I didn't take it because I didn't know if I was going to winter the whole time. But really, I reckon it's because I was scared to leave for a year and a half. And then they said, oh, you can go 6 months to do the summer because they're not wintering. I was like, yes, I'll go do that. But then having done that, and I saw what life was like down here, and I saw how amazing it is down here, and the science that's produced and the sceneries that you see, I was like, yeah, there's no way I can't not come back.
So it was hard to leave when you had to leave Bali after
a
short time.
I could have done this if I hadn't done a six-month season beforehand.
How is Rother different from your initial expectations?
It's a lot older.
Yeah. Much older building. It's a lot. Lots of history.
It's Halley was built from the ground up. Everything was designed from the ground up. Everything is streamlined and works really well. And it is designed with cutting edge technology. Whereas here, there's a lot of technologies that we're relying on that are really old, and infrastructure that is kind of built on top of old infrastructure, which is built on top of old infrastructure, which all needs maintaining. There is so much interesting stuff here that I'm always learning. There's always some old technology which is being used. There's always something to learn. There's always some instrument that some scientist sends down, which you've got to reverse engineer. Oh, it's really clever. How do they do that? You look in, amazing. It's a constant learning. And not even that, it's like going out with the boaties one day and learning how to moor up a rib against the side of a wharf, or going to do chief AFA training. Did I tell you I'm chief AFA?
No, never heard that.
I'm the second backup person in Antarctica.
Oh, what a responsibility to carry.
Yeah, splendid, mate. That's excellent at removing.
And also, you're the only person with the certificate, or one of the only people to do internal chamber operations. That's another insight.
Yeah, ops. So, yeah, there's three people on station who can do ops. And ops is like radio flight following in the tower. So any flights that come here or nearby and they need flight following, so that's something that I'd never experienced before.
So the flight following is essentially the pilot communicating at certain checkpoints along his voyage. If he's successfully reached that checkpoint, giving weather conditions?
No, so we give them weather conditions of us, the destination, and any other airfields in the area, which he could bail out if needed.
What are the greatest challenges that you've overcome so far, or that you've had to deal with?
Missing home is a big challenge. It is hard to underestimate how much, because there's so much. It's not just the family, it's the freedoms. It's I'm going to go drive to the coast and enjoy. There's a flag line, I don't know if you know this, but there's a flag line which you have to stick within, and it can be constraining, and it's hard to sometimes find motivation to do things. So you want to climb the mountain, but you can't. You got to live within your means, and you adapt, you find different things to do. So instead of going outside and normally I'd go climbing at the peaks, you find a new hobby. You go to the craft room or the chippy shed. So that took a while to kind of understand that you have to find a new outlet for a lot of things, which was a challenge. But yeah, I feel like got there.
Does that change your perspective of things, having to adapt your life in a slightly different way and finding other ways of entertaining yourself?
It's made me realise how much I rely on outdoors. Like, personally, like, I didn't think that I would intertwined with being outdoors, but I realise now that it's a core feature of my personality, which I didn't know, which is really interesting. It's like being outdoors is something that makes me happy. And I'm going to make a conscious effort when I go back to spend as much time outdoors and as I can. And that's something that I wouldn't... I live in London, right? So normally I think of it as blasé. If I get out to the Peak District, it's all right, it's a day out. But now I'm going to make active journeys every week.
That's a really interesting thing to take away from it. Mm. And so this is actually a good lead up into the winter trip. So you've been away... You've just come back from a super cold week in the field with a field guide.
Mm.
So talk to me about that. What did you do? How cold was it?
It was below minus 30. It was freezing. It was hard because to do anything is hard. Like, you have to wear mitts at those temperatures and you can't do your for example, your harness up with mitts on. So you 5 minutes without gloves and you can't feel them. You've got to put them on. Everything is just a lot slower. And then putting up a tent or... putting a tarp on a skidoo, they harden, everything turns to concrete and you're trying to bend fabric and it's hard to be warm the whole week. I don't think I was warm once. I think I was okay.
What's it like going to bed in the sleeping bag?
Awful. Like, my feet constantly were cold at night and then I had to sleep with a hot water bottle between them. And then, like, I put my head under the sleeping bag to use my breath to warm my body up, but then it'd get really moist. I put my head out and then I'd fall asleep and wake up and my nose would have, like, ice underneath it, and then it'd be really cold. I didn't want to get frostbite, so it was like constantly alternating between head in, head out, and then Mark would do the same. So he'd wake me up and I'd wake him up, and then
like, so just sleepless nights of continuously waking up.
Yeah, so the whole, instead of the tent iced up, so when we removed the tent and cracked like the fabric, just
it was just all your sweat,
all the sweat,
like a pile of sweat that was frozen on the floor of the field guide building. So what's your best memory of this winter?
Ah, we went to Stork Bowl, right. We went to Stork Bowl for a whole day. A Stork Bowl is this ridge which you need a field guide to get to, where you can go do some pretty advanced skiing and snowboarding. And so it's been a whole day at this place, Stork Bowl. Got some amazing views, amazing. Oh, this was actually when the sun was setting as well. So this is the last time we saw the sun, just really nice kind of dreamy atmosphere. And then on the way back, we decided to stay at the Caboose. And the Caboose is this shipping container near station, maybe 10 minutes could do right away. But it's out of the view of station, so it's a bit isolated from everyone else. And you have to use tiddy lamps and primer stoves to cook and stuff. So we stayed there, with five of us. And when we got there, after a whole day of skiing, we didn't rest. We just built an igloo out because we could, because we're in Antarctica. And we built this igloo. And it was just an amazingly fun time. Everyone's chipping in. And then we stayed in this igloo. And it was just such a nice vibe.
And really nice starry night, clear day.
Yeah. Yeah, it was magical.
If you could go back in time, what would you change?
Nothing. I'm happy. I wouldn't change a thing. Oh, chamomile tea. I'd bring chamomile tea down.
That is actually being ordered for next year.
Good. Did someone drop the ball?
Well, thanks so much, Jas, for your time.
Oh, it was lovely.
It was lovely.
Let's do it again.
And thankfully, we got a delivery of chamomile tea at Rothera during Jas's final summer. Jas can't stay away from Antarctica, so he's been down with a tourist organisation as a guide and a boat driver on two separate occasions. As you've heard, there's so much more to living and working in Antarctica than snow and ice and science. All aspects of living and working on the continent have to be managed with every level of human support and input. It's so rewarding and unique. And if you like the sound of Jonathan and Jas's role, do check out the job section of the British Antarctic Survey's website, where openings at the many bases are posted regularly. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please do tell people and take some time to write a review. It really helps us spread the word. I'm Nadia Frontier, and thank you very much for listening.